In the minimal shelter of their colorful tents, the trainees slept on the rocks, cold during the night, baking hot during the day. Gray clouds of spewed ash blocked the sun. They sat without chairs, ate dried and salted food, drank tepid water that had been stored in old casks. Everything had an aftertaste of sulfur. No one complained about the hardships. By then, swordmaster trainees knew better. In the rough environment, they learned about metaphors and verse. Even on ancient Terra, honor-bound samurai warriors had valued their prowess in composing haikus as much as they valued their skill with a blade. When Mord Kur stood on a rock beside a steaming hot spring and recited ancient epics, the passion in his voice stirred the students' hearts. Finally, when the old man saw that he had made them all teary-eyed, he smiled and clapped his hands. Jumping down from the rock, Kur announced, "Success! Good! Now it is time to learn fighting." Clad in flex-alloy chainmail, Duncan rode astride an enormous armored turtle that kept snapping at its reins and its rider. Lashed into his saddle, legs spread to encompass the broad-plated shell, he balanced a wooden pike with a blunted metal tip. He held the shaft over one wrist and stared across at the three similarly armed opponents. The fighting turtles were hatched from stolen eggs and raised in cove pens. The sluggish behemoths reminded Duncan of when he'd had to fight while wearing thick plate armor. But their horned jaws could slam shut like blast doors, and when they had a mind to, the turtles could lurch forward with hellish speed. Duncan could see from chipped and broken plates on the shells that these beasts were veterans of more combat than he had ever seen. Duncan wrapped his lance on the turtle's thick shell, thumping like a drummer. His beast stomped forward toward He-Eresser's mount, thrashing its monstrous head from side to side and snapping at anything in reach. "I'm coming to unseat you, Eresser!" But Duncan's turtle chose that moment to stop, and no amount of urging could get it to move again. The other turtles wouldn't cooperate either. The turtle joust was the ninth fighting event in a decathlon the students had to pass before they were admitted to the next level of the class. Through 5 grueling days breathing ash-thick air, Duncan had never placed lower than third. In swim fighting, long jumping, crossbows, slingshots, javelins, aerobic weightlifting, knife throwing, and tunnel crawling. Throughout, standing on his high rock, Mord Kur had watched the proceedings. Eresser, who had become Duncan's friend and rival, also achieved a respectable score. The other Grumman students formed a clique of their own, clustering around the bullyish leader Trin Kronos, who seemed immensely full of himself and his heritage, though his demonstrated fighting abilities did not set him much apart from the others. Kronos crowed about his proud life serving House Moritani, but Eresser rarely talked about his home or family. He was more interested in squeezing every bit of ability from Ginaz. Each night, deep into the hours of darkness, Duncan and Eresser would set to work in the base tent library with a pile of film books. Ginaz students were expected to learn military history, battle strategies, and personal fighting techniques. Mord Kur had also impressed upon them the study of ethics, literature, philosophy, and meditation. All the things he had not been able to learn as a feral boy in the forested cliffs of Hagal. In evening sessions with the swordmasters, Duncan Idaho had memorized the Great Convention, whose rules for armed conflict formed the basis of imperial civilization following the Butlerian Jihad. Out of such moral and ethical thinking, Ginaz had formulated the code of the warrior. Now, while struggling to control his curmudgeonly turtle, Duncan rubbed his red eyes and coughed. His nostrils burned from the ash in the air, and his throat felt scratchy. Around him the ocean roared against the rocks. Fumaroles hissed and spat rotten egg stink into the air. After constant ineffective prodding, Eresser's turtle finally lunged forward, and the redhead had all he could do to remain seated and keep his blunted lance pointed in the right direction. Soon all the turtles began to move, lumbering together in a slow-motion frenzy. Duncan dodged simultaneous pike thrusts from Resser and the second opponent, and struck out at the third with the butt of his own weapon. The blunt end of the lance bashed the student squarely on the chest armor, sending him sprawling. The downed trainee landed heavily on the rough ground, then rolled out of the way to avoid the snapping turtles. Duncan flattened himself against the shell of his mount, evading another thrust from Resser. Then Duncan's turtle halted in its tracks to defecate, which took a long time. Glancing around, helpless in his saddle, Duncan saw the remaining mounted adversary go after Resser, who defended himself admirably. While his turtle completed its business, Duncan waited for precisely the right moment, positioning himself to one side on the hard shell, as near to the combatants as he could get. Just as Resser countered with his own weapon and knocked down the other combatant, he raised his lance in a show of triumph, as Duncan knew he would. At that very moment, Duncan reached over and slammed his pike into the redhead's side, tumbling Resser off the turtle. Only Duncan Idaho remained, the victor. He dismounted, then helped Resser climb to his feet and brushed sand from his chest and legs. A moment later, Duncan's turtle finally began to move, lumbering about in search of something to eat. "Your body is your greatest weapon," Mordkor said. "Before you can be trusted with a sword in battle, you must learn to trust your body."
"But, Master, you taught us the mind is our greatest weapon," Duncan interrupted.
"Body and mind are one," Kor responded, his voice as sharp as his blade. "What is one without the other? The mind controls the body. The body controls the mind." He strutted along the rugged beach, sharp rocks crunching under his calloused feet. "Strip off your clothes, all of you. Down to your shorts. Take off your shoes. Leave all weapons on the ground." Without questioning orders, the students peeled off their clothing. Gray ash continued to fall around them, and brimstone gases sighed up from fumaroles like hell's breath. "After this final test, you can all be quit of me and of this island." Mordkor pursed his lips in a stern expression. "Your next destination has a few more flowers and amenities." Some of the students gave a ragged cheer, tinged with uneasiness about the ordeal they were soon to face. "Since all of you passed the Thopter pilot competency test before coming to Ginaz, I'll keep my explanation brief." Kor gestured up the steep slope to the high crater lip, surrounded in hazy gray murk. "A craft awaits you on top. You saw it on your way in. The first to reach it can fly away to your clean and comfortable new barracks. Coordinates are already locked into the piloting console. The rest of you will walk back down the mountain and camp here on the rocks again, without tents and without food." He narrowed the eyes on his ancient face. "Now go." The students raced forward, using their energy reserves to get a head start. Although Duncan wasn't the fastest student off the mark, he chose his route more carefully. Steep cliff bands blocked some paths halfway up the sheer cone, while other couloirs tapered off to dead ends before reaching the top. Some gullies looked tempting. Thin streams and waterfalls promised a slippery, uncertain ascent. Upon seeing the Thopter high up on the crater rim during their initial approach, he'd studied the slope with avid interest, preparing himself. Now he drew upon everything he had observed, and he started up. As the terrain steepened, Duncan gained on those ahead of him, skillfully choosing gullies or couloirs, scrambling up rugged, knobby conglomerate rock, while others got sidetracked into easy-looking gravel chutes that crumbled beneath their feet and sent them tumbling back down. He ran along connecting ridges and rounded shoulders that did not lead directly to the top, but provided easier ground and permitted a faster ascent. Years ago, when he'd raced for survival in the rugged forest guard preserve on Gedi Prime,
Rabban had tried to hunt him down. By comparison, this was easy. The rough lava rock was sharp beneath Duncan's bare feet, but he had an advantage over most of his fellow students, calluses developed by years of walking without shoes on the beaches of Caladan. He skirted a hot spring and climbed a fissure that gave him precarious hand and footholds. He had to wedge himself into the crack, searching for protrusions and crannies he could use to haul himself up another body length. Some of the rotten rock broke loose and tumbled. Elsewhere, he had no doubt that Trin Kronos and some of the other self-centered candidates would be doing their best to sabotage the competition, rather than focusing on increasing their own pace. By sunset he reached the lip of the volcano, the first in his class. He had run without resting, climbed dangerous scree slopes, chosen his route carefully but without hesitation. With other competitors not far behind him, coming up all sides of the cone, he leaped over a steam vent and ran for the waiting ornithopter. As soon as he spotted the craft, he looked over his shoulder to see Hii Resser stumble up close behind him. The redhead's skin was scratched and covered with ash. "Hey, Duncan!" The air was thick with fumes and dust belched out from the crater. The volcano rumbled. Close to victory, Duncan put on a burst of speed, closing the distance to the thopter. Resser, seeing he had no chance of winning, dropped back, panting, and gracefully acknowledged his friend's victory. At the crater's far rim, Trin Kronos pulled himself up from an alternate route, his face flushed and angry at seeing Duncan so close to the waiting thopter. When he saw Resser, his fellow Grumman student, stagger to a breathless halt and concede, Kronos looked even more furious. Though they came from the same world, Kronos often went out of his way to express scorn for Resser, to humiliate the redhead and make his life miserable. In this class it was survival of the fittest, and many of the students had developed an intense dislike for each other. Just watching the way Kronos harassed his fellow Grumman trainee, Duncan had formed a harsh opinion of the spoiled son of a nobleman. Once Duncan flew off in the thopter, Kronos would probably wait for his Grumman friends, and they would pummel Resser to vent their own frustrations. As Duncan placed one foot in the empty craft, he reached a decision. "Hii Resser, if you can get here before I strap in and take off, I'm sure the thopter will carry two of us." Farther away, Trin Kronos put on a burst of speed. Duncan snapped on his safety harness, touched the retractor bar to shorten the wings for jet boost takeoff, while Resser stared in disbelief. "Come on!" Grinning, the redhead found new energy. He sprinted forward as Duncan slid the starter switch into position. In his years of service to the Duke, he'd been taught to fly by some of the best pilots in the Imperium. Now he went through the motions smoothly. Railing against Duncan's decision to break the rules, Kronos raced forward, his feet kicking up broken rock. The thopter's instrument panel flashed on. An illuminated orange box told Duncan the jet pods were armed, and he heard the low, powerful hiss of the turbines. Resser leaped onto the thopter skids just as Duncan raised the vehicle with the jet assists. Panting, the redhead grabbed the edge of the cockpit door and held on. He gulped in lungfuls of air. Seeing he would never make it to the vessel, Trin Kronos stooped to snatch up a jagged, fist-sized lava rock and threw it, striking Resser's exposed hip. Duncan depressed a glowing action sequence button, and the wings snapped up and down, climbing high above the lava cap of the volcano. The jet pods kicked in, and the wings went into lift attitude. He let up on the power. Resser hauled himself all the way inside in a tangle of arms and legs. Wheezing and out of breath, he wedged himself into the meager open space beside Duncan in the cockpit and began to laugh. The wind of the ornithopter's beating wings blasted the disappointed Kronos. Left behind, the young man hurled another rock, which bounced harmlessly off the plaz window shield. Duncan waved cheerfully and tossed Kronos a handlight from the thopter's supply kit. The Grumman caught it, expressing no gratitude for the assistance in the growing dark. Far behind him, the other students, fatigued and aching, would return to camp on foot to spend a miserable, cold night out in the open. Duncan boosted power, extended the wings to their fullest setting. The sun sank below the horizon, leaving a red-orange glow across the water. Darkness began to fall like a heavy curtain over the string of islands to the west.
"Why did you do that for me?"
Resser asked, wiping sweat off his brow.
"This was supposed to be a solo test. The Swordmaster certainly didn't teach us to help each other."
"No," Duncan said with a smile. "It's something I learned from the Atreides." He adjusted the instrument panel illumination to a lambent glow and flew by starlight to the coordinates of their next island. Never underestimate the power of the human mind to believe what it wants to believe, no matter the conflicting evidence. Cade Monerb, Politics and Reality. In an effort to understand how the Sisterhood had short-circuited his demands, the Baron and Peter de Vries huddled in the metal-walled conference room of the Harkonnen military frigate. The ship orbited Wallach 9, weapons ready, but with no target. For 2 days, hourly comlink messages had been sent to the Bene Gesserit, without any response. For once the Mentat had no answers as to where or how the witches had hidden. No probabilities, projections, or summations. He had failed. The Baron, who accepted no excuses for failure, and de Vries had failed him, was prepared to kill someone in a most unpleasant manner. Feeling like an outsider, a brooding Glossura band sat to one side watching them, wishing he could offer some insight. "They're witches, after all, aren't they?" he finally said. But no one seemed interested in the comment. No one ever listened to his ideas. Disgusted, Rabban left the conference room knowing his uncle was glad to see him go. Why were they even discussing the situation? Rabban couldn't tolerate sitting around, getting nowhere. It made them all appear weak. As the Baron's heir presumptive, Rabban thought he had done well for House Harkonnen. He'd overseen spice operations on Arrakis, had even launched the first surreptitious strike in what should have been an all-out Atreides-Tleilaxu war. Time and time again he had proven himself. But the Baron always treated him as if he were slow-witted, even calling him a muscle-minded tank brain to his face. If they had let me go down to the witches' school, I could have smelled them out. Rabban knew exactly what needed to be done. He also knew better than to ask permission. The Baron would only say no. And the Baron would be wrong to deny him. Rabban would solve the problem himself and claim his reward. At long last, his uncle would see his capability. In heavy black boots, the burly man strode through the frigate corridors, intent on his mission. Around him, the armed ship droned along in the silent embrace of gravity. He heard snatches of conversation as he passed cabins and duty stations. Men in blue uniforms hurried by, performing their duties, always deferential to him. When he gave his command, the men dropped their tasks and hurried to slide open a bulkhead wall. Rabban stood with his hands on his hips, satisfied to gaze upon the hidden chamber that held a sleek, highly polished vessel, a one-man warcraft, the experimental no-ship. He had flown the invisible fighter inside a guild highliner more than a decade ago, and the ship had performed its duty impeccably, completely silent and unseen. His pilotry had been flawless, though the scheme had ultimately failed. Too much planning had been the fatal error before, and Leto Atreides, damn him, had refused to behave as expected. This time, though, Rabban's plan would be simple and direct. The ship and its contents were invisible. He could go anywhere, observe anything, and no one would suspect. He would spy on what the witches were up to, and then he could wipe out the entire mother school if he wished. He engaged the whisper-quiet engines of the attack craft, and it dropped through the bottom of the orbiting frigate. With increasing anticipation, Raban activated the no-field generator, and the ship vanished in open space. During his descent toward the planet, all ship's systems functioned properly. The glitches from recent test flights had been repaired. High over a range of grass-covered hills, he banked toward the stucco and sienna-roofed buildings of the mother school. So the witches thought they could just disappear when the Baron demanded an audience? Were they snickering at their own cleverness? Now the witches refused to answer repeated demands for a conference. How long did they imagine they could avoid the issue? Touching a sensor button, Raban armed the weapons. A massive, unexpected strike would engulf libraries and rectories and museums in flames, leveling them all to rubble. That'll get their attention. He wondered if the Baron had even discovered his departure yet. As the silent craft swooped toward the school complex, he saw shifting crowds of women outside the clustered buildings, foolishly confident that they no longer needed to hide. The witches thought they could thumb their noses at House Harkonnen. Raban cruised lower. His weapons system grew hot. Targeting screens glowed. Before he wrecked the main buildings, perhaps he would pick off a few of the vulture-like females one at a time, just for sport. With his silent and unseen ship, it would seem like a fiery finger of God striking them down for their arrogance. The no-ship came into range. Suddenly, the witches all looked up at him. He felt something press against his mind. As he watched, the women shimmered and vanished. Then his vision blurred, and he felt his head throbbing, hurting. He pushed a hand against his temple, trying to focus. But the pressure within his skull increased like a bull elephant rampaging against his forehead. Below, the images shimmered. The crowds of Bene Gesserit flickered into view again, then dissolved into after-images. The buildings, the landmarks, the planetary surface, all wavered. Raban could barely see the controls. Disoriented, his head splitting with agony, Raban grasped the piloting console. The no-ship squirmed like a living thing beneath him, and the vessel went into a spin. Raban let out a gargling, befuddled cry, not even realizing his danger until crash foam and restraint webbing slammed around him. The no-ship caromed into an apple orchard, ripping a long brown furrow across the ground, then tumbled over onto its back. After a groaning pause, the ruined craft skidded down an embankment and into a shallow creek. The mangled engines caught fire, and greasy blue smoke filled the cockpit. Raban heard the hiss of fire suppression systems as he clawed himself free of the foam and protective restraints. Choking on bitter smoke, blinking acid tears from his eyes, Raban activated an escape hatch in the belly of the ship and crawled from the wreckage. He tumbled off the hot, slippery metal and landed on his hands and knees in the steaming water of the creek. Befuddled, he shook his head. Looking back at the no-ship, he saw that its hull flickered in and out of visibility. Behind him, women swarmed down the embankment like black-robed locusts. When Baron Harkonnen received the unexpected comlink message from Mother Superior Harishka, he wanted to strangle her. For days, his shouts and threats had gone unanswered. Now, though, as he paced the floor of the frigate's command bridge, the old crone initiated contact herself. She appeared on the oval system screen. "I'm sorry I wasn't available when you visited, Baron. And I apologize that our comm systems were down. I know that you have something to discuss with me. Her tone was maddeningly pleasant. But I wonder if you might like to have your nephew returned first. Seeing her thin lips smile beneath those evil almond eyes, he knew his corpulent face must reflect his utter confusion. He spun to look at his troop captain, then at Peter de Vries. Where is Rabanne? Both men shook their heads, as surprised as he was. Bring me Rabanne! Mother Superior gestured, and a few sisters brought the burly man into view on the screen. Despite bloody scrapes and gashes on his face, Rabanne appeared defiant. One of his arms hung limp at his side. His trousers were ripped at the knees, revealing jagged wounds beneath. The Baron cursed under his breath. What has that idiot done now?
He suffered some sort of mechanical malfunction in his vessel. Was he coming to visit us, I wonder? Perhaps to spy? Or even to attack?
Next, a video image of the wrecked no-ship appeared on the screen, still smoldering at the edge of a ruined orchard.
He was flying a most interesting craft. Note how it phases in and out of view. Some sort of a damaged invisibility mechanism? Most ingenious.
The Baron's eyes nearly bulged out of his head. Gods below, we've lost the no-ship, too! Not only had his stupid nephew been caught by the Sisterhood, he had let the no-ship, the Harkonnen's most powerful secret weapon, fall into the hands of the witches. Moving silently, Peter de Vries whispered in his ear, trying to calm him.
Take slow, deep breaths, my Baron. Would you like me to continue negotiations with the Mother Superior?
With a supreme effort, the Baron composed himself, then stepped away and turned back to the screen. He would deal with Rabanne later. My nephew is a complete dolt. He did not have my permission to take the ship.
A convenient explanation.
I assure you he will be severely punished for his brash actions. Of course, we will also pay for any damages he caused to your school. He grimaced, chagrined at how easily he had conceded defeat.
A few apple trees, no reason to file a claim, or report to the Landsrad, if you cooperate.
Cooperate? His nostrils flared, and he reeled backward, nearly losing his balance. He had evidence against them. And would your report include a summary of how your reverend mother unleashed a biological weapon upon my person in violation of the Great Convention?
Actually, our report would include a bit of speculation, Harishka said with a vice-tight smile. You may recall an interesting incident a few years back when two Tleilaxu vessels were mysteriously fired upon inside a guild highliner. Duke Leto Atreides was accused of the atrocity, but denied the charges, which seemed preposterous at the time since no other ship was nearby. No visible ship, at least. We have confirmed that there was also a Harkonnen frigate in the vicinity, en route to Emperor Shaddam's coronation.
The Baron forced himself to remain motionless. You have no proof.
We have the ship, Baron.
The image of the flickering wreckage appeared on the screen again.
Any competent court would come to the same conclusion. The Tleilaxu and the Atreides will be most interested in this development, not to mention the Spacing Guild.
Peter de Vries looked from the Baron to the comm screen, wheels turning in his intricate mind, but he could find no acceptable solution. "You're talking yourself into a death sentence, witch," the Baron said in a low growl. "We have proof that the Bene Gesserit unleashed a harmful biological agent. One word from me and—"
"And we have proof of something else, don't we?" Harishka said. "What do you think, Baron? Do two proofs cancel each other out? Or is our proof far more interesting?"
"Provide me with a cure for my disease, and I'll consider withdrawing my accusations," On the screen, Harishka looked at him wryly.
My dear Baron, there is no cure. The Bene Gesserit use permanent measures. Nothing can be reversed.
She seemed mockingly sympathetic.
On the other hand, if you keep our secrets, we will keep yours. And you may have your troublesome nephew back. Before we do anything else that might be irreversible.
De Vries interrupted, knowing the Baron was about to explode.
In addition, we insist on the return of our crashed vessel.
They could not allow the Sisterhood access to the no-field technology, though the Harkonnens themselves did not understand it.
Impossible. No civilized person would want to see such an attack craft repaired. For the sake of the Imperium, we must take steps to arrest the development of this deadly technology.
We have other ships, the Baron said.
She is a truth-sayer, my Baron, De Vries whispered. The old Bene Gesserit looked at them deprecatingly while the Baron sweated for a better response.
What will you do with the wreckage?
The Baron clenched his fists together so hard that his knuckles cracked.
Why, make it disappear, of course.
When Rabban returned, the Baron gave him a cane thrashing and locked him in his stateroom for the duration of the trip back to Gedi Prime. Despite all his foolish impulsiveness, the burly man remained the heir presumptive of House Harkonnen. For now. The Baron paced the floor and pounded on the walls, trying to imagine the worst punishment he could inflict upon his nephew. An appropriate penalty for the incredible damage Rabban's clumsy attack had caused. Finally, it came to him, and he smiled tightly. Immediately upon returning home, Glossu Rabban was sent to the remote planet of Lankavile, where he would live with his weakling father, Abelard. It is the Atreides' way to be examples of honor for our children, so that they may be the same for their own progeny. Duke Leto Atreides, first speech to the Caladan Assembly. 18 months had passed. A full moon bathed Castle Caladan in silver, casting shadows of the turrets along the edge of the cliff that overlooked a troubled sea. From his discreet vantage in the ornamental garden, Thufir Hawat saw Duke Leto and Kylea Vernius strolling along the verge of the precipice, star-crossed lovers. She had been his official but unbound concubine for more than a year, and sometimes the two enjoyed quiet, romantic moments like this one. Leto was in no hurry to accept any of the numerous offers of marriage alliances that came to him from other houses of the Landsrad. Hawat's constant surveillance irritated the Duke, who demanded some measure of privacy. But as security commander of House Atreides, the Mentat did not care. Leto had a troubling tendency to place himself in vulnerable positions, to be too trusting of the people around him. Hawat would rather incur his Duke's disfavor by being too attentive than allow a fatal mistake to slip past his scrutiny. Duke Paulus had died in the bullring because Hawat hadn't watched closely enough. He vowed never to make such an error again. As Leto and Kylea walked in the chill night, Hawat worried that the trail was too narrow, too close to a deadly drop into the rocky surf. Leto refused to permit guardrails. He wanted the path exactly as his father had left it, since the old Duke had also walked along the headlands, pondering problems of state. It was a matter of tradition, and the Atreides were brave men. Hawat scanned the darkness with infrared glasses, saw no movement in the shadows other than his own troopers stationed on the trail and along the base of the rock face. With a tiny black light, he signaled two of the men to take different positions. He had to be constantly on the alert. Leto held Kylea's hand and looked at her delicate features and her dark copper hair blowing in the night breeze. Her coat collar was turned up around her slender neck. As stunningly beautiful as any lady of the Imperium, Romber's sister carried herself like an empress. But Leto could never marry her. He must remain true to traditions, as his father had done, and his grandfather before that. The course of honor and political expediency. However, no one, not even the ghost of Paulus Atreides, could argue against such a union if the fortunes of House Vernius were ever restored. For months, with Leto's wholehearted support, Romber had secretly been sending modest funds and other resources to Kater Pilru and the freedom fighters of Ix through surreptitious channels. And he had received bits of information in return, schedules, surveillance images. Now that he had taken some action at last, Romber seemed more vital and alive than he'd been in a long time. Pausing at the top of the trail that led down to the beach, Leto smiled, knowing Hawat was somewhere nearby, as always. He turned to the woman beside him. "Caladan has been my home since childhood, Kylea, and to me it is always beautiful. But I can see you're not really happy here." A night gull flew up into the air, startling them with its thin screams. "It's not your fault, Leto. You've already done so much for my brother and me." Kylea didn't look at him. "This just isn't where I had imagined I would be." Knowing her dreams, he said, "I wish I could take you to Kaitain more often, so that you might enjoy the Imperial Court. I've seen how you light up at gala events. You're so radiant that it makes me sad having to bring you back to Caladan. It isn't glamorous here, not the life you are accustomed to." The words were an apology for all the things he could not offer her. The luxury, the prestige, the legitimacy of belonging to a great house again. He wondered if she understood the sense of duty that bound him. Kylea's soft voice sounded uncertain. She had seemed nervous all afternoon. She paused on the path. "Ix is gone, Leto, and all the glamour with it. I have accepted that." They turned to gaze in silence upon the night-black ocean before she spoke again. "Romber's rebels can never overthrow the Tleilaxu, can they?" "We know too little about what's really going on there. Reports are scattered." "You think he's better off not trying?" Leto looked hard at her with his smoke-gray eyes, trying to understand her anxiety. "Miracles can happen." She seized the opening she had been waiting for. "Miracles, yes. And now I have one to tell you, my Duke." He looked at her with a blank expression. Kylea's lips curved in a complex smile. "I am going to have your child." Stunned, he froze in place. Far out at sea, a pod of mermuns sang a deep song as a counterpoint to throbbing sonic buoys that marked the treacherous reefs. Then, slowly leaning down, Leto kissed Kylea, felt the familiar moistness of her mouth. "Are you pleased?" She sounded very fragile. "I didn't try to conceive. It just happened." He stepped away from Kylea, held her at arm's length so he could study her face. "Of course." He touched her stomach gently. "I've imagined having a son. Perhaps now would be a good time for me to consider obtaining another lady-in-waiting," Kylea asked anxiously. "I'll need assistance in preparing for childbirth, not to mention help with the baby when it is born." He hugged her with strong arms. "If you want another lady-in-waiting, then you shall have her." Thufir Hawat would check out any candidates for the Atreides household with his usual thoroughness. "I'll get you 10 if you wish." "Thank you, Leto." She stood on her toes to kiss his cheek. "But one should be sufficient." Dust and heat hung over everything. Hoping that the dry climate might help his condition, Baron Harkonnen spent more time on Arrakis. But he still felt miserable. In his Carthag workroom, the Baron reviewed spice harvesting reports, trying to concoct new ways to conceal earnings from the Emperor, from Chome, from the Spacing Guild. Owing to his increasing bulk, the desk had been customized with a cutout to accommodate his belly. His flaccid arms rested on the gritty desktop. A year and a half ago, the Bene Gesserit had brought him to an impasse, with threats and counter-threats, blackmail in both directions. Rabban had lost their no-ship. He and the witches had remained at a safe but uneasy distance from each other. Still, the wounds rankled, and he grew weaker and fatter every day. His scientists had been trying to build another no-ship, without the assistance of the Rachesian genius Chobin, whom Rabban had slain. The Baron saw red every time he thought of his nephew's numerous blunders. Plans and hollow recordings of the original construction process had been flawed, or so the Baron's scientists claimed. As a result, their first new prototype had crashed into the obsidian slopes of Mount Ebony, killing the entire crew. Serves them right. The Baron wondered if he would prefer a sudden death like that to torturous debilitation and decay. He had poured an enormous amount of salaries into a state-of-the-art medical research facility on Gedi Prime, with the grudging part-time assistance of the Rachesian Sook doctor Wellington Yue, who was still more interested in his cyborg research than in finding ways to help the suffering Baron. The Rachesian premier still hadn't sent him a bill for the services. But the Baron didn't care. Despite all this effort, there had been no results, and continued threats didn't seem to help. For the Baron, the simple act of walking, which he'd once done so effortlessly and with such grace, was now a major task. Soon the wormhead cane would not be enough. "I have news of an interesting development, my Baron," Peter DeVries said, gliding into the dusty Carthag offices. He frowned at the interruption. The gaunt Mentat, wearing a pale blue robe, hid his sappho-stained smile. "The concubine of Duke Leto Atreides has sent inquiries to the Imperial Court, seeking the services of a personal lady-in-waiting. I came to inform you as soon as I was able. However, because of the urgency involved, I took the liberty of setting a plan in motion." The Baron raised his eyebrows. "Oh? And what is this interesting plan that you felt needed no approval from me?" "There is a certain matron living in the household of Suwak Hesban, the son of Elrud's former court chamberlain, Aiken Hesban. For some time now, she has provided us with excellent information on the Hesban family. At my instigation, this matron, Kiara Rash Olin, has let it be known that she is interested in the Atreides position and is to be interviewed on Caladan.